My name is Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics may participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Lisa will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the willingness to know the difference. Alan will read the steps.
I'm Alan. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, saw through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Renee will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Renee, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Emma.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Emma, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, guys. Okay, so what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was at home in Albuquerque last month at my parents' house, and I found my 9th grade yearbook, and I had X'd out my own face. And I couldn't, what self-hatred. And the next year, 10th grade, I have a memory of drinking the wine coolers that I had convinced my mom to buy for me at the grocery store for like a special treat or something. And talking on the phone with, you know, like the cool guy in my English class. And, you know, so that was a real kind of memory of, you know, the self-hatred and where I was at sort of in the 9th grade. And then I found alcohol and I felt great. I was on the phone with this guy and I felt loose and I felt great. And, fast forward to like 10 years later and still, you know, 3 years before making it into this program, I was hiding in the closet from my boyfriend because I didn't want to talk. So that makes sense. I think about how I qualify for this program, and you know, I have a scar on my back from falling downstairs at a party, and people asked me afterwards, "Were you drinking?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, but you know, I wasn't drunk," and it's kind of an amazing scar, and I stepped out down the stairs into the basement. And, I could have broken my neck. I could not be here. And, my friend, we took the Bactine, sprayed it, slapped a Band-Aid on it, and good to go again. I have recently connected with some of my friends from college. We were in a band together. And, I just heard that one of them, he's, like, smoking every 15 minutes. He can't live without, medicating himself in that way every 15 minutes. And the other one is, always fascinated by the fact that that I'm still sober, that I'm in AA, but, it won't work for her somehow, for some reason. Before I moved to New York and consequently got sober, I was in therapy, and I remember whenever it would come time to renew my sessions, my therapist and I would sit there and talk about what we were going to write on the form to renew the sessions, and send this to the health insurance company. And I'd be like, I don't really want that on my medical record. Can we just say, nothing about that, but this, and, just like bargaining and justifying how, what was unacceptable was acceptable. And sometimes I think that therapist was trying to get me to realize that I had a problem, and it wasn't long after that I made it to AA, but sometimes I think she was just trying to get me to see that I was making a decision at some point in the night to get blasted, and I'm not sure. Anyway, so I moved here in 2002, and, you know, I didn't have very many friends. I went out drinking like three times with those friends, and two out of those three times were humiliating and degrading and really embarrassing, to the point where I didn't really have those friends anymore. And it suddenly became very clear to me that I could no longer drink safely. And I think that was grace. I promised my brother, for some reason, you know, I don't know if he would say it today, but also by grace, he said to me, you know, about a little over 6 years ago, well, what are you going to do about it? They say you can't do it on your own. And so I promised him I would go to a meeting. And I went to, you know, I looked online. I didn't ask for any help. You know, I didn't call a number or anything. You know, I looked online. I found the meeting I was going to go to on Friday night. Had no idea, you know, that I could just go to a meeting probably right away, as lucky as we are in New York. I went to that meeting on Friday night. I didn't talk to anybody. I went back a week later. No idea that, you know, I could have gone every night. But I got my sponsor at that second meeting. I got my first sponsor. And we got going. She got me to go to a meeting every day. And at one point, I was wigging out. And I was like, it's too many meetings. It's making me crazy. And she kept me, you know, she kept me at that meeting. She like, enlisted the help of other women. And they all talked to me. And, you know, she kept me there that night. And who knows if I'd still be there if she hadn't. And she helped me in a lot of other ways, too. But I didn't have an easy time with sponsorship. I've had a few sponsors, and I'm very grateful for my current sponsor, Melissa H. Now I'm going to lose it completely. Got a few years into the program. I was in my fourth year, and I was going to meetings and complaining about why everybody seemed to use this fear mentality, and I seemed to only be hearing that, you know, if you stop going to meetings, you'll drink. And so I was at a meeting complaining that why is everybody saying if you stop going to meetings, you'll drink? And which is, you know, I don't think fear is a great motivator, but it's a motivator. And that's when I found my way to the Atlantic Group, and it's all really turned around since then. You know, I'm not kind of heading away from the program anymore. I'm not coming to complain. I'm just caught up in the structure and the service and really enjoying my, you know, my big life and meetings and service and AA. I am part of the treasury team here at the Atlantic Group, very trusted in that capacity, and we're a great team, and I'm also a GSR for another meeting, and so I get to see how, you know, the service structure works at below the group level, and that's been really exciting. I got to be a hand model for the Grapevine magazine. Ed took the photo. That was really exciting. I have the great honor of, even though my company, you know, everybody's kind of struggling right now, and our company had to go into hibernation, I am one of, like, two employees, and that's how trusted I am, that they needed to keep me for continuity's sake. And it's just, you know, I went to the 26th anniversary party of a woman on Sunday night that I met downtown. You know, I got sober downtown, and so I know people in AA all over town, and, you know, they know me, and I've been reaching out again. That's something that I learned in the beginning, that it was easy to kind of set aside. I've been letting people know that I'm prepping to take the GMAT. I'm thinking about going to business school, and lo and behold, you know, you just let people know, and the encouragement and the support floods in, and, you know, and I ask for help, and that's the only way people know that I need it, and that's kind of, you know, if I, I wanted to talk about that tonight. Thank you. And I still have a minute left. That's really what I've been thinking about lately is how, you know, the things that my first sponsor told me and the things that I learned in the beginning, you know, all of the tools, all of the, you know, it's pretty simple. We just repeat it. And it's just these simple tools. And they work just as well today. They work just as well, you know, later in sobriety as they do in the beginning. And it gets sometimes a little harder to pick them up if we get out of practice. But it's kind of fun to realize you can pick them up again and all of a sudden have this flood in again of encouragement and support. And you think, thank you. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is George.
Hi, my name is George. I'm an alcoholic. First, I want to thank Jiro for asking me to speak and for doing so several months ago, so I've had plenty of time to prepare and worry. But, you know, it's still my story. And the best way really for me to sum up my story is I'm a slow learner, and I'm a slow learner because I'm stubborn and prideful. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on October 13th, 1996, and I had my last drink on December 8th, 2006, a lapse of like 10 years and 2 months. So that needs some explanation. Let's go back to my first drink that I remember. It wasn't my first drink, it was the first one that I really remember. I grew up in a family which was, you know, it was heavy drinking all the time. It was drink and rage. And I just wanted to escape from as early as I can remember. I wanted to escape. And my first escape was to religion. I became a fundamentalist Baptist at the age of 12. For a gay teenager, that's not a good thing to do, to try and escape. Then, at the age of 15, I joined this weird religious cult. I'm not going to mention any names, but I started running away from home. And by the time I was 16, I'd run away from home with this cult. We basically made our living by begging on the streets. And there was one day, for some reason, instead of just going back to the house where we lived, we'd been begging on the streets all day in Liverpool, in England. And on the way back, the guy who led that house in Liverpool, he took us into a pub and bought us all a beer. It was a pint of lager. And I so remember that pint of beer. I remember very little about anything else from that period. It's over 30 years ago now. But I do remember that beer, and I remember that effect that I had. You know, and I wanted another one right away, and they wouldn't let me have one. And the whole cult thing didn't work out because they liked to give direction, and I didn't like to take direction. So pretty soon I was back home, but this time it was me, my drunken, rageful family, plus alcohol. You know, and I'd found what I needed to survive with them. And within a year, I was a daily drinker. I went off to college. I was smart enough that I didn't have to work too hard. And from there on, and for 17 years, I was a daily drinker. My idea of not drinking was 2 beers. Anything over 2 beers was drinking. Anything under 2 beers was not. There was never 1 beer. There was a period when I had such bad gastritis from drinking so heavily that I had to stop drinking, and I discovered other substances were helpful then, but I won't talk about them because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, alcohol was, I loved it. I liked to get drunk, and I get drunk every day, and had no concept of drinking other than for the effect of getting drunk. And I kept that up. I drifted through life. I'd made no decisions. It's hard to make decisions when you're hungover. The major decision for the day was how to cure the hangover and how to get the next drink. And as long as that was taken care of, you know, I went wherever you wanted me to. You know, if a door opened, I went there. If it closed, I went another way. And that was my decision making. And I drifted through Europe, and I drifted eventually to New York. Wasn't well thought out. They came and hired me in London. I was working in London. They came and hired me and paid for the plane tickets and did the visa. I'm there. And I came here for a year, and I'm still here 17 years later. And I did not make good decisions a lot of the time. I just went wherever you wanted me to. You know, and it was here in New York that I hit bottom. You know, I was drinking, I couldn't drink beer anymore because I couldn't get drunk enough on beer. So I'd switched to gin, another good decision. And with the gin, the blackout started. And pretty soon I was blacking out. I moved into my own apartment for the first time. And I was terrified. I was alone, drunk, waking up in vomit. You know the routine. And somewhere along the line, I'd heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. One time in nursing school from a man who'd come as a public service commitment he had. He came and told his story. And another time it was a friend of a friend in Philadelphia who was himself sober. And I knew he was an AA. He never said a word about it, and I knew he knew about my drinking. And it was I had lunch with him one day, and he said, if you need a glass of wine, go ahead. And I knew he knew me so well. If I need a glass, of course I need a glass of wine. And like those two people sowed the seed for me. So eventually, when I couldn't take it anymore, I picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that began my journey, and I went to a meeting the next day, October 13th, 1996. And I didn't drink for 6.5 years. And I'd like to say that I was happy, joyous, and free, that, but I wasn't, thank you. I went through it. The first couple of years were wonderful because the immediate physical effects of constant drinking wore off. And there was I was 34 years old, as if I was still that 16-year-old, you know, suddenly sober, full of energy, full of ambition. I loved AA for a couple of years. I went through the steps. I didn't really work the steps. I did write a fourth step and told it to my sponsor in a fifth step. But recently, thinking back and thinking about the second and third step, I never did those steps. It was still my show. And I was one of those people, my mantra was, don't drink, go to meetings, and everything will be okay. Don't drink, go to meetings, and everything will be okay. And I didn't drink, and I went to a gazillion meetings, and this suddenly energetic teenager that was 35 years old, so all of a sudden developed this ambition, and I was off on my own and making all my own decisions. And it took me another 4.5 years or so before I eventually picked up a drink. And it was running my own show. And for most of that time, I was governed by fear, fear that I wasn't going to get what I wanted. And my sponsor, in name only, I certainly never went to him for any advice. And, you know, I ran the show, and I'm sure I heard the solution in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was going to, but I wasn't listening. And eventually I picked up a drink, and I picked up a drink swearing blind that if it didn't work out, I would be right back. And I was right back 3.5 years later. And, you know, it wasn't the same as before. I was determined to control my drinking, and for most of the time I did, except when I didn't, and I could never predict when that would be. You know, and I started coming back to meetings after about a year or so, after my first big blackout. And I developed this pattern. My partner, we were living together he didn't like it when I drank, bit of a problem. So I had to hide my drinking for the first time ever. And every time he went off to see his family, which he did a couple of times a year, he'd go off for a week or two, I ended up back in AA. Because as soon as he was out the door, I was off to the races. And within a day, I would be having blackouts, and it would all fall apart. And, you know, that went on. I counted days for about 2.5 years, which is a miserable life for anybody to have. And I was, by the time I finally made it in back in December of 2006, I was completely hopeless. I did not want what I had the first time around. I was miserable as a sober man, and I did not want that. And I thought that was the only way. And so it took a lot to beat me into submission. It took a lot to get me back in these rooms and to get me willing to ask what I needed to do to get sober. And it took my partner leaving me. And finally, when he left, and I realized that there was no more external control, it was just me and the bottle, and we knew who was going to win there. And you know, I came back, I finally prayed for help, and I finally got the help I needed. And what got me back was that I met a member of this group at my first meeting back, and who tricked me into going to the Sunday night meeting. I'm still not quite sure how he did it. But I got there, and there I met my sponsor. And his first words to me were, "Are you done?" And I so wanted to be done. I wasn't sure if I was done. I didn't think I could be done. I didn't think that for this alcoholic I would ever not drink. But I was done. And then, strangely enough, I said, "I have no idea how to stay sober. Can you tell me?" And he did. And it turns out it's in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it had just been published in 2006 when I came back. Thank you. You know, and so a sponsor, somebody who'd been there before me, who was sober, who'd worked these steps, not read through them, but worked them and taken the actions there. He just told me what he had done, which is the same as his sponsor had done and his sponsor had done. And, you know, little by little, I began to recover. And I have absolutely no doubt that left to my own devices, I'll end up drunk. I don't know when. Eventually, I will. I've proven it over and over and over again that, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to drink. So therefore, I need something greater than me, a power greater than myself to keep me, to stand between me and that drink. And through sponsorship and through meetings and service, through working 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis, not once and then over, but every single day going back to God and resetting the count to zero so I can begin again. Every day is a new beginning for me, which is truly amazing. I was a completely hopeless case when I came here. And if you feel like you're the same, you know, you haven't been able to get it, good. It's a good place to start. That's all I've got. Thanks.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dayton. My sobriety date is April 9th, 1990. My sponsor's name is Kevin Haney. I spoke to him this morning. My home group is the Atlantic Group. I've had a service commitment at this group since 1994, and I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12. And a lot of us in this group introduce ourselves that way, and I'm glad that we do. It reminds me that I'm active in AA, and I think that's one of the greatest gifts that I've had, is the fact that 19 years into sobriety, I'm still active in AA. There's never been a time that my sponsors had to say, "I think you've got to up your program, get to more meetings." And my story's been that I just keep getting more active, and I really hope I can come back here in a couple of years and say the same thing, that I'm more active in the future. Then, of course, my mind's always in the future instead of right now. I didn't know that I was speaking tonight. At 5 o'clock, it was at home. I was thinking about going out to get a haircut, and the phone rang. And Heidi asked if I was going to the meeting. I'm like, yes. She's like, well, Thea, the speaker that was going to speak, her plane got rerouted, and she's in Hartford, Connecticut, and she likely will not be able to make it. So it wasn't until during the secretary's break that I found out that I'm the actual 30-minute speaker. And Bill Wilson would call me a Bush League pinch hitter. And, you know, we're lucky in this group. We got a lot of speakers who are really gifted that have a lot of good things to say from the podium. And in my opinion, really the recovery, though, hopefully I'll be able to say something that will help someone new or that is struggling with sobriety, but the real recovery takes place one alcoholic sitting down with another alcoholic after the meeting, before the meeting. And, you know, we're lucky to be here. And When Heidi told me that the plane was rerouted, it reminded me of a spiritual axiom of mine that I developed recently, is that everybody will get off the plane. And what I mean by that is right now in the metropolitan area, there are probably a few dozen planes that they've pulled into the gate and the hatch door hasn't opened. And if I'm spiritually ill, a lot of other people are spiritually ill, but when that happens, I'm not thinking, how can I help another sick and suffering? I'm in my seat, and I rush to get on the plane, too. I'm like the guy, like, you know, I want to get on the plane. But once we pull into the gate, I'm looking around, and I'm reading minds. I'm reading people's intentions. And I'm like, has the door opened yet? Why isn't anybody helping that woman with her bag? And the one that really gets me is a guy behind me that I think is going to get down the aisle before I get into the aisle. And so that's just wasted time. But that's where my mind goes, because I'm spiritually sick, and I can take what seems to be a relatively minor incident and just conjure all these storylines in my head. And what we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, so we've got to quiet the mind, that even though we're conditioned to think that way, that type of thinking eventually will lead us back to drink, because it's those feelings that cause us to drink. And sometimes we hear people in AA say that feelings aren't facts. And, you know, that's certainly true. But I get a little uneasy with that because it's the feelings that are going to drive me to drink. I'm going to drink over the feelings. We're feeling people. That's why AA works, because we just can't read it in a book. We've got to have that experience where we actually feel it. And so for me, you know, I have this irrational fear of becoming homeless. And right now it doesn't look like it's going to happen, but I will, in my head, I'm like, well, I've got a tent, you know, I'll move down, you know. And that's, you know, I shouldn't be thinking that way, but I'm sure that if for some reason I was struck homeless, I'd be fine. I'm not going to drink over the facts. I'm only going to drink over the feelings. As I stated at the outset, I'm an alcoholic. Back when I was in college, I used to do these things called a cannonball. And what that was is I would snort a line of Coke, and then I would go up on my head. That's why I wear bow ties all the time, because in the fraternity house at the formals, like, the tie will flop into my face. So I go up on my head, do a bong hit, hold the smoke in. Someone would stick a funnel in my mouth. I'd do a beer upside down. Then I'd come down, drink the bong water. That was tough to do upside down. Let the smoke out, and then I'd go against the wall and, like, do a Farmer Jones with the blood coming out my nose. And then I'd yell, cannonball. That really doesn't have anything to do with alcoholism. I'm an alcoholic, and drugs have no place in AA. I'm not an addict. At least I don't think I'm an addict. And when I came in the early 90s, there was a lot of talk about drugs. Everything was Coke this, Coke that. And I'd venture to guess that probably over half of the people in this room are actual addicts as well as alcoholics, and they're recovering successfully in AA. But even though I was convinced when I got to AA, I wasn't one of these guys that got to AA and like, am I an alcoholic? Am I not an alcoholic? I knew I was an alcoholic, but I wanted to drink again. And I would hear people going on about the cocaine. I'd sit there and say, well, you know, Coke really wasn't a problem for me. And that's a dangerous place for us to be. And that's why we have the singleness of purpose. So we focus on the recovery from alcoholism. And, you know, a lot of us come in here with other things. And the good news is a spiritual solution will help us in those areas as well. But I like to stick to alcoholism because that's my prime problem. I am a real alcoholic. It talks on a big book about the real alcoholic is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's usually insanely drunk. And, you know, I want to be mildly intoxicated. You know, that's attractive to me. And when I'm getting ready to speak, and Emma's speaking, and she talked about wine coolers. And my mind starts thinking, I wonder how many wine coolers I could drink before I get insanely intoxicated. And, you know, it's just, it's crazy stuff. And the thing is, in AA, it doesn't, in the 10-step promises, it doesn't say that we'll never be tempted by alcohol. It says that we'll be seldom tempted by alcohol. And my problem is that I know deep down what is going to take away the big hurt. Alcohol, in many respects, is a cure for alcoholism because it quiets the voices, it makes me at ease. The problem is I'm an alcoholic and I have a physical craving for alcohol, meaning that once it gets into my system, phenomenon of craving is set up and I go to the races. I don't drink to get drunk, I drink to satisfy a craving. And there's nothing at all that can be done about that craving. I'm going to go to the grave with that craving. And sometimes you read articles, they're talking about developing a pill that supposedly alcoholics will be able to take, that will be able to, I guess, drink successfully, if there is such a thing. And I mean, I don't know why they're wasting the money on that, because there's no pill that's going to make me put my hand over the glass of wine and say, no thanks, I've had enough. And the strange thing about everybody wants to sell us pills, but the other thing about the pill is they haven't developed this pill yet, but I started thinking, if I take twice as much of the pill, will I be able to drink twice as much? And, you know, the main problem of the alcoholic rests in the mind, and that also takes away the fact that I suffer from a spiritual illness. You know, that's my main, yes, alcohol is my problem, but I'm separated from alcohol for 19 years now. but I suffer from a spiritual illness. And if you're new, that means it talks about in the doctor's opinion that I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. And we're not unlike most people. In AA, we don't have a monopoly on spiritual illness. Most people are spiritually ill to one degree or another. The difference between us and them is, for me, when I get those feelings, I know that my reaction, something good happens or something bad happens, I'm going to drink. And once I drink, it may temporarily relieve those symptoms, but I have the physical craving. The physical craving kicks in, I get thrown into that cycle of spring and remorse. Other people that have spiritual illness, they don't necessarily turn to alcohol. So what I learned in AA is that the spiritual illness has to be addressed. And I'll talk about that hopefully in a few minutes. But a little more about my drinking. I drink a lot. And, you know, again, it all gets down to the, like, sometimes I'll sit in AA, and I hate to admit this, but I'm like, I drank more than that person because I did drink a lot. But it doesn't really matter how much we drink. It's that spiritual illness that I was talking about. I think sometimes, you know, I've seen this happen where someone young comes into AA, and there's kind of this attitude, well, you know, you only drank for a couple of years, you didn't drink that much, so get a little AA under your belt and go off with life. And, you know, that takes the whole spiritual illness out of the equation, because someone can be 16 years old and the spiritual illness is just as bad as someone, you know, who's lived a full life, or someone who, you know, maybe they have three or four drinks and that sort of thing. The spiritual illness is the same, and the spiritual illness is what we address here. I used to get cut off in bars in New York City. And one place where I used to get cut off on a regular basis, my friends owned the bar. They knew I wasn't driving, but I would just get so intoxicated that they were like, we're not serving this person anymore. And, you know, being in New York City, I'd leave there and, you know, go to the next place. And I just always, my fear as an alcoholic was that the alcohol was going to run out. And since I lived alone, I didn't really hide alcohol. But I remember when I was living in Virginia, I used to go to football games. And what I would do is I would get 3 fifths of bourbon before going to the game. And one would be for, like, drinking outside the game, and the other two would be for drinking inside the game. And so I'd have that one that I'd drink, plus all the other alcohol that was around. And what I'd do is I would take that bottle that was just about empty, and I'd stick it in my breast pocket, and then I'd stick the other two down in my shoes, and because they search you going in. And later on what I did is I got things called barnoculars that, like, you could screw off, like, the lens, and you could hold them up. And so I would go through the line, and the guy would search me down, and it was like my red herring. He'd find the bottle, like, ah, and then I'd, like, breeze in, comforted in the fact that I still had 2 bottles of bourbon to go. You know, I spent most of my time drinking in a blackout. I really don't remember a lot of my drinking story. I was pleased on those seldom nights when I did not go into a blackout. And I'm not going to go into the circumstances of what led me to AA, but I'm grateful that I was alive when I got to AA, because most alcoholics die drunk. Most alcoholics, they go to the grave secure in the knowledge that their level of drinking doesn't rise to what they consider an alcoholic to be, or that their alcoholism is different. And, you know, Clancy talks a lot about how we want to think that our case is different. We suffer from alcoholism. This isn't like heart disease, where there are many different variations of heart disease. We all have the same thing. We have alcoholism. We have that alcoholic insanity. And when I first got to AA, my first day, someone who is a good friend of mine today said that the definition of an alcoholic is someone whose life gets better when they stop drinking. And as I said before, I knew that I was an alcoholic before I got here. And that really made a lot of sense to me, but since I've been in AA, I've learned that that's not really a very good definition of alcoholism. Yes, our lives do get better when we stop drinking, to the extent that a lot of the collateral damage goes by the wayside. When we're not staying up all night, we're generally making it to work. We're not spending all of our paycheck on alcohol. We're not going into blackouts and creating intolerable conditions for ourselves. So I suffer from a spiritual illness, and when I first got here, I got a sponsor who I was lucky to have for 17 years before he passed away. And very early on, he told me that if you're not working the steps, you're just resting between drinks. And that, I find that that's really truant. With some misgivings, I spent a lot of time on steps 1, 2, and 3, and you know, those are the foundation of our recovery. But for me, I like wanted to have it like absolutely nailed down perfectly. You know, I wanted certainty out of those steps. Why are we doing this? And I don't want to say the problem, because they're important steps, but if we're just spending time when we first come in on steps 1, 2, or 3, we're not changing. And that's what we have to do in order to stay sober, is we have to change. Most people, they don't drink over steps 1 through 4. We drink over steps 6 and 7 because we're not changing. And so I launched into the course of action, and the steps 1, 2, or 3 can be like, if you're here and you've been to a couple meetings, chances are you've already worked steps 1, 2, and 3. They're really just propositions. Steps 1 and 2, there are no real directions on the big book how to work them. And basically, they want us to agree to certain concepts. And right now, I'm like sporting about 10 extra pounds. And I want to look good on the beach in August. So I decided that what I'm going to do is, like, over the weekend, I'm going to lose some weight. And but let's just say that I've never heard of a diet before, and I'm carrying the extra weight, and I admit I have a problem. I've got extra weight that I have to lose, and someone says, well, you know, there's a thing called a diet, and if you eat less and exercise more, you lose weight. And I'll say, gee, that's interesting. And I believe, because you're telling me that that's true, that it's going to work. And that's step 2. Basically, we're saying, look, we found a solution that has worked for us, and as a new person, we're agreeing, well, maybe I'll try this out. And then step 3 is where I made the decision to start on the diet. I made the decision on Sunday, and so far I've been pretty good about it. But those are basically steps 1, 2, and 3 that I made a. I admit that there is a problem. I think that there may be a solution that works for you, and I've made a decision that I'm going to try this. And where a lot of us get caught up, especially in long-term sobriety, is step 2. Because that's step 2 is why I come back to meetings on a regular basis. Step 2 is why I'm active in AA, because despite everything that I said at the beginning of my qualification, there are times that taking a drink makes perfect sense to me. And you know, that's what we're protecting against, that one split moment that we're on the beach and there is a cooler or beer, and we'll say, oh, I can, it's only beer, I can drink this. That's what we're preventing against. And, you know, the disease of alcoholism is most dangerous when we're sober, because it's when we're stone cold sober that we have that thought that we can drink safely. And if I didn't have that thought, I wouldn't be here right now. I wouldn't be working with other alcoholics. But the good news is, besides staying away from a drink, my life is getting better because of working the steps. I'm moving closer to God. And the third step is a vital step that, you know, I'm agreeing. I have these warp concepts. There's a great line on the third step that says, isn't he a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness from life if he only manages well? And that's me to a T. And what happens to us, if you're new, we come into AA and our lives get better because, as I said, the collateral damage goes by the wayside and the alcohol is removed from the equation. But then invariably, what's going to happen is all of a sudden the spiritual illness is going to kick in, and we think that our human instincts aren't going to be met. And once that happens, then the self-centered fear kicks in. We're thinking about ourselves. It activates our character defects, and then our thoughts go to drinking. You know, what can I do to relieve this? And you know, that's we see all the time. People come into AA, and their lives get better, and then they drift away. And a lot of them end up drinking again, and, you know, a lot of them just end up not happy. And so what we get to do by coming here is we get this enriching life. And so in the third step, it says that we had a new employer being all-powerfully provided what we needed if we kept close and performed his work well. And basically, I just have to trust that something is taking care of me. And the third step, one of the toughest things for me about the third step is it says, it doesn't matter exactly the prayer that we say so long as we voice it without reservation. I've got reservation, and that's what I try and do on a daily basis, is trying to live a life where I completely turn my life over to the care of God. And the care, that's a wonderful word, but for me, I want to kind of turn my life over to the care of God. And, you know, that's a danger. Like, God, I trust that you're going to take care of X, Y, and Z, but I'm not going to trust you in my relationship and the career. And what we have to do is we have to completely trust that this power is taking care of us. And especially right now, you know, there are a lot of things going on with the economy or whatnot. The source comes from God. We're going to be provided for. It doesn't mean that we can't take any action. You know, the birds flying in the air, they're not worried about they're not thinking where their next meal's coming from. But by the same token, they're out doing the work. They're not sitting, you know, on the ground waiting for worms to drop out of the sky. They're doing what needs to be done. But they're creatures of God, and God wants us to be that way too. God doesn't want us to be caught up in that calamity of the mind, thinking, you know, what am I going to do to make my life better? And, you know, that's where we run into problems, because we think that we can manage our lives, and all we really have to do is we have to let go and trust that God is taking care of us. And I'm self-centered. My biggest character defect is self-indulgence. Like, if I think it's going to make me feel better, I'm going to go for it. But as soon as we, like, give that up and we become selfless, like Van always used to say, this isn't a selfish program, it's a selfless program. As soon as we do that and we start thinking of others, our lives get better. You know, in the third step in the seven-step prayer, it doesn't say we do these things so that we feel better. It says, do this so that we can demonstrate your omnipotence, or that we can better serve thee. But the trick of AA is we know that by getting out of self, we're going to feel better. And it's just an amazing thing. And so many people, most people, you know, you go into Barnes & Noble, everybody wants to expand their spiritual horizons. And we're really lucky in the sense that we get to come here to AA, and on a daily basis, we can take our spiritual temperature. Like, I come to a meeting, I have a thing, my cell phone is set to go off at 2 o'clock every day to remind me to think about God, because even though I'm living a God-based life and a spiritually centered life, I can get going. And, you know, I'm not living, we're living in the material world, but I'm, you know, not paying enough attention to the spiritual. And oftentimes at 2 o'clock, the cell phone will vibrate in my pocket. I'm like, oh, it's 2 o'clock. I haven't been thinking about God. But for me, getting to a meeting, I get to sit and I get to listen to people speak about recovery, and I get to think to myself, am I thinking about myself most of the time? What am I doing to contribute to the stream of life? And that's what we do here, is we try and get out of self. You know, when we go home to our families, sometimes that can be plagued with difficulties. Go in with the attitude, what can I do to help? Can I take the trash out? Can I load the dishwasher? And there are simple things like that. But then driving away, we're like, you know, that was a nice trip because I wasn't thinking about myself. And I do a lot of spiritual reading. Most nights I read a couple. I have like a dozen different books. And what I found over time is that all the great spiritual thinkers essentially say the same thing, that we have to quiet the self-absorbed mind and trust that something is taking care of us. And it's that simple. And it's not enough just to read that in a book. And what AA does is it gives us a template. It gives us a plan of action. AA is kind of assembly line spirituality, that you start at the beginning and at the end you'll have a spiritual awakening by taking these steps. And it's really an amazing thing that we get to do that. And as I mentioned before, so many people want to have this spiritual life, but we're blessed that we get to live it. And, you know, there's a wonderful line in the eighth step that it talks about, we place the outcome in God's hands. So many times I'm, like, afraid to do something that is recommended to me in sobriety, and I made a decision that, you know, I'm living a second life at this point, And, you know, I'm lucky that I'm still alive, so I've got to place the outcome in God's hands and go about and do it. And if I'm not willing to place the outcome in God's hands, that means that I'm trying to run my life on self-will, and that's what we're really trying to avoid here. And, you know, coupled with that and the family afterward, there's a great line that we don't get to see too often, because generally in step studies, we don't read the family afterward, but it says that in God's hands, our dark past can be our greatest asset. With it, we can help others avert death and misery. And that's such a phenomenal promise that, you know, we come in here to stop drinking, but we actually have the opportunity to help others avert death and misery. And, you know, a lot of people don't get that opportunity. And it says in the book that we're beyond human help. That, and, you know, that's something that I really have to remember when I'm working with sponsees and people that are new. I really can't do anything to help someone. I can show them a message, but at the end of the day, God is going to take care of them. And I had an experience about a year ago. I was outside the church, and there was a guy visiting town who used to live in the city. We were friendly at one point, and he sporadically come to this meeting, and then he moved away. And so I hadn't seen him in a while, and he took me aside and he said, you know, I really want to thank you for that talk that we had a few years. You saved my life. And, you know, I'm thinking, what did I say? You know, I can't, but, you know, the guy was being earnest at that moment, and I believed him, and I wasn't going to, you know, ruin it with that. But you know, it's just awesome that you know, according to him, I saved his life. And again, it's God in the mix, but those are the type of experiences that we get to have. And we never know exactly when we're helping someone. That can happen at any time. And, you know, that's why we have to show up. A lot of times people will say in AA that the most important person in the room is a newcomer. And yeah, that's true, that the new person's important. That's the person that we're going to help. That's the person that by helping, we help ourselves. My own opinion, and this isn't an opinion of AA, but I really think that the most important person in the room is a person between 5 and 15 years. Because that's the time, there are a lot of people between 5 and 15 years that they start to slip away from AA. And I think 15 isn't a magic number, but I find that once people have reached that point, they tend, you know, the habit is there. They've made AA a part of their life. And, you know, it's those people in that period of time that they're the ones that really, they're the ones that are here helping. And, you know, if my sponsor used to say, you know, you can have a meeting without me, but I can't have a meeting without you. And it's important that we continue to show up. AA has given me countless gifts that, you know, I'll never be able to return. You know, a lot of times people talk about their wildest dreams, and I had some pretty wild dreams, and a lot of them have been fulfilled. But when I came here, my wildest dreams didn't include peace of mind. And, you know, that's what I've got now, is I got peace of mind. And, you know, I can trust that God is with me at this very moment. The only time that we can have a conscious contact with God is at this very moment. You know, I can't have a conscious contact with God 2 weeks from now, or, you know, something can't be happening. I'll say, well, I was spiritual 2 months ago. Right now, you know, when I'm agitated or doubtful, I have to ask myself, what is it that's blocking me off from God? What is a poison inside of me that if I pray to have it removed, reach out to another person, be helpful, that I'll be fine with my fellow men and God? And, you know, that's basically the 10-step formula that I've... A lot of times I see people that have drifted away from AA and they come back and I'm like, well, you know, I've got to go on a 30-day meditative... You know, the easiest thing that we can do is sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, let's have a conscious contact with God. It's a very easy thing to do, but we throw up these defenses of why we can't do it. And, you know, the book has a lot of great lines in it, but I really like where it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And then also, like, around the same time it says, you know, God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, when I came in, I was afraid to turn my will and life over to the care of God because, you know, the church lady doesn't go bowling. We trust God, But we have a lot of fun. And, you know, they're not at Memorial Sloan Kettering telling people, you know, take this chemotherapy and you're absolutely going to enjoy life. And that's the gift that we have. We have a fatal disease. This is the only fatal disease that the sufferer ends up in better condition after taking the treatment than before they were diagnosed. And, you know, we're certainly lucky for that. And I have a saying, FIS, fun and sobriety, that I've had a blast. I've done, before there was talk, Rajesh was talking about the fellowship and the program, I've had a lot of fun. I had some good times drinking. I've had some great times sober. And I've done things that I never would have, beyond my wildest dreams, I never would have thought of. My time's just about up. And, you know, if you're new and this doesn't make any sense, find someone. There are a lot of people here that are willing to help, that have gone through the steps. You know, be willing to give it a try, and your life will get better. As I said, we end up in better condition after we take the solution than before we were diagnosed. And to bring my whole, you know, everybody's going to get off the plane full circle, since the time that I started speaking, most of those people are probably off the plane by now, but now they're at the luggage carousel. The bags are going to come as well. I just want to close. I met with a spiritual healer one time, and he gave me a great prayer that I think is the most pure prayer that we can say, and it's one that I say often. It basically says, God, I don't understand you, but I trust you.